Thanks, Sue. And can I also note that during our time on the Council, we were often accompanied by the Secretary-General, so I'd like to thank the organisers for making sure he was present with us for the entirety of the conference. It's only reassuring for us. Just over a year ago, the Security Council conducted a visit to 5 countries on 2 continents in 5 days, maintaining its usual pace of work. I was fortunate enough to be Australia's representative on that trip, as Gary had to stay in New York to deal with the MH17 crisis. After a stop in Belgium to commemorate the outbreak of the First World War, we visited The Hague, where, in one remarkable day at the Peace Palace, we met the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, the criminal tribunals for Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, and for Lebanon. We discussed our respective roles and the imperative of accountability for those most responsible for grave violations of international humanitarian law. During a tour of the Peace Palace, at the end of a corridor, council members came across a statue of Henri Dunant, witness to the Battle of Solferino, proponent of rules of law, and founder of the Red Cross. For council members, his presence in the Peace Palace seemed entirely fitting. Four hours later, we're in South Sudan. 9 months previously, the world's youngest country had fallen apart at the seams. Political divisions in South Sudan's government had led to armed clashes between different factions of the military. Conflict broke out in Juba and quickly spread across the country. Ethnic-based militia took control of large swathes of territory. All sides used military force indiscriminately, targeting civilians and committing atrocities. Hundreds of thousands of civilians fled to escape the violence. During its visit, the Council urged both sides to the conflict to immediately re-engage in peace talks and to ensure that forces under their respective control ceased violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. We threatened sanctions and promised accountability for those responsible for mass atrocities. That afternoon, we flew up to Malakal, a town in the north of South Sudan that's changed hands 10 times during the conflict. We visited the UN mission in South Sudan's base there, in which almost 20,000 civilians had taken shelter. This had followed the unprecedented move by the Special Representative of the Secretary General at the height of the violence to open all UN bases in the country to civilians. In a period of 48 hours, UNMISS extended protection to 80,000 civilians. Representatives in the Malakal base's inhabitants told us they needed and expected the continuing protection of the United Nations. The juxtaposition between The Hague and South Sudan for the Council was stark, but together they encapsulated the breadth and complexity of the Council's work, the role of the Council in maintaining international peace and security, the essential work of peacekeepers, the importance of IHL being respected and enforced, the establishment of mechanisms to hold accountable those who breach IHL, and at its heart, the expectation and imperative of the protection of civilians. IHL has developed markedly over the past 70 years. From the Geneva Conventions of 1949, we moved to the 2 additional protocols of 1977, clarifying key elements of IHL and its application in non-international armed conflict. Specific treaties constraining the use of particular types of weapons, landmines, cluster munitions, blinding weapons and so on, and particular means of warfare have emerged. We've also had a comprehensive effort by the ICRC to compile a definitive study of customary international humanitarian law. We now also have 2 decades of jurisprudence from the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. And as the Council marked the 20th anniversary of its establishment of those tribunals, we reflected on their remarkable record in ensuring the protection, the prosecution of virtually all indictees and their contribution to the development and application of international humanitarian law. Of course, these institutions led to the creation of a permanent international criminal tribunal. For that purpose, the International Criminal Court. But while we have this highly developed body of IHL and some institutions to ensure accountability for those who violate it, what we do not have currently is an interstate mechanism to assess and ensure implementation. The government of Switzerland and the ICRC are currently leading an effort to establish such a mechanism, and Australia is closely engaged. for the foreseeable future, the key institution able to call for adherence to IHL remains the UN Security Council. IHL permeates almost everything the Council does. In almost every conflict on the Council's agenda, IHL and serious human rights violations feature as both consequences of and drivers of further conflict. The Council invokes IHL frequently. An instruction to abide by and uphold IHL often forms part of the exhortation by the Council for action by the relevant actors to restore peace. It's frequently presented as an essential component of achieving an end to a particular conflict. The Council usually invokes IHL in a general way without precise formulation as to the key issues. This lack of specificity stems from often a lack of information about the conflict or the particulars of it, or most commonly, a difference of view about those facts. Also, the pace and the volume of Council work militates against careful and detailed analysis and pronouncement on specific IHL issues. And of course, the Council is not a court. But Council decisions do support and reinforce IHL precepts on a daily basis. The Council's efforts to improve IHL implementation features not only in the manner in which it engages in specific country situations, but also in its thematic work on women, peace and security, children and armed conflict, for example, and also in the work of its sanctions committees, which often list alleged perpetrators of IHL violations as targets of individual UNSC sanctions. Following the travesties of Rwanda and Srebrenica, the protection of civilians has become the primary focus of the Council. We heard a considerable amount about it yesterday. 9 of the 16 current peacekeeping operations contain a POC mandate, and the Council has consistently made clear its expectation that peacekeeping operations will utilise these mandates. But the fall of Goma in the DRC in November 2012 highlighted the deficiencies. The Council's decision, which you've heard about, in March 2013 to reshape the MINUSCO mission by establishing under Resolution 2098 a force intervention brigade with responsibility to, quote, neutralise armed groups, end quote, was a game changer. Over the following 9 months, the FIB elements of MINUSCO took decisive military action against M23 forces, eventually driving them from DRC. This robust peacekeeping has been controversial. For some, it took UN peace operations beyond the core principles of peacekeeping. But peacekeepers are increasingly deployed into asymmetric threat environments where peacekeepers and humanitarian actors are frequently targeted. We need to give force commanders the support and the tools they need to prevail. The Secretary General's high-level review of peace operations, which Leanne mentioned yesterday, acknowledges this, and there will be much more discussion to be had. The decision by the UNMISS leadership to open the gates of UN bases to protect civilians at the height of violence in South Sudan demonstrated another means of protecting civilians. Certainly it has had its own consequences, but the Secretary General urged all UN missions to act first, consult later in similar situations. The response of UNMISS suggested that the promise of UN protection was finally a bit closer to being fulfilled. But while the approaches by the Council and UN peacekeeping operations in the DRC and South Sudan indicated some advance, the ever-worsening conflict in Syria provided the counterpoint. As Australia's role in securing Council action on humanitarian action in Syria was covered by Gary Quinlan yesterday, I won't repeat that now. But I would like to note that our successful efforts in securing a Council consensus around a presidential statement and then 3 consecutive Council resolutions were all founded fundamentally in the precepts of international humanitarian law. These texts demanded that all parties to the conflict cease their violations of IHL, including the use of barrel bombs, targeting of humanitarian personnel and facilities, attacks on civilians, and the denial of humanitarian access. When it became clear our demands in Resolution 2139 were not being adhered to, we worked to ensure the adoption of a further resolution, 2165, authorising cross-border humanitarian access regardless of the consent of the host country, Syria, a first. This success ensured we had a leading role not only on humanitarian issues in Syria, but humanitarian issues across the board on the Council agenda. The large-scale use of chemical weapons in the Ghouta area of Damascus on the 21st of August 2013 was as fundamental a breach of IHL as could have been imagined. For the month that followed, Council consensus on a response looked remote. But late on the night of 26 September, the US and Russian permanent representatives convened Council consultations and jointly tabled a draft resolution requiring the dismantlement of Syria's chemical weapons program. Resolution 2118, adopted unanimously the next day, declared that the use of CW by anyone, anywhere, was contrary to international law. A unique joint UN and Office of the Prevention of Chemical Weapons mission monitored vigilantly Syria's response to that resolution. It has not been perfect, but it has made very considerable progress against the chemical weapons use that was first targeted, and I note that a week ago the Council decided on an accountability mechanism for CW use, or the use of chemicals as weapons, and some will appreciate that distinction, in Syria. The inherent link between peace, security and human rights is apparent in the preamble to the Charter. Australia consistently advocated through our term for recognition of this linkage. This reinforced the Secretary-General's own Human Rights Upfront initiative, which emphasised to the entire UN system the requirement, quote, to take early and preventive action, early and effective action rather, as mandated by the Charter and UN resolutions, to prevent or respond to large-scale violations of human rights, or IHL. The most striking indication of progress was the Council's response to the groundbreaking report by the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea. Again, this was covered to some extent yesterday. The decision underlined that situations of mass human rights violations, including those not directly committed in conflict situations, are nevertheless of core concern for the Security Council. It was a striking example of the application of the responsibility to protect principle by the Council. Australia was a consistent proponent of the need for accountability for those most responsible for serious violations of IHL and international human rights law throughout our term. But the Council's record of support for accountability mechanisms was mixed. Relations with the ICC remained difficult, with the Council remaining unable to express support for the ICC prosecutor's efforts, even in respect to the two situations the Council itself had referred to the ICC in Darfur and Libya. The Council was also unable to respond to the graphic evidence of horrific torture carried out by the Assad regime on an industrial scale in Syria's prisons. A French draft resolution seeking to refer the situation in Syria to the ICC was vetoed in May 2014 by Russia and China. But on the other hand, the Council established a Commission of Inquiry into Human Rights Violations in the Central African Republic and included the Commission of Crimes Against Humanity and Serious Human Rights Violations as criteria for individual listings under a number of sanctions regimes. In the past few months, the CAR government has decided to establish a hybrid tribunal to deal with these crimes, a direct result of Council pressure. I won't dwell on the responsibility to protect. Gareth Evans did that very well yesterday, and I know that Ramesh Thakur will follow me and address the future of the R2P principle. But I should note that the utility of the concept as a motivating factor for action is now no longer questioned. It certainly motivated much of Australia's action on the Council. Related to the R2P principle is a welcome debate on the restraint of the use of the veto. Initiated by France, the idea that the permanent five each commit to voluntarily refrain from the use of the veto in respect of resolutions relating to situations of mass atrocity, a considerable appeal across the UN membership. No other permanent member has yet committed, but in expressing our support for the proposal, Australia reminded the P5 that we had led opposition to the veto at San Francisco. Faced with the devastating consequences of the many persistent conflicts currently underway, it would be easy to conclude that the impact of IHL as a constraint on behaviour is far too limited. But we should not judge its value solely by the violations. IHL remains a clear threshold for behaviour, one that many armed forces observe scrupulously. It's a benchmark for council action and central to the protection of civilians. It provides the basis for accountability. It remains imperative. Thank you.